You should know that I have had this story pent up inside of me for 61 years.
But the allure was too great for any little children with any sense of adventure. And a minute later, we were on the other side of the fence.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, Me in 1963, we have two storytellers sharing unforgettable personal experiences from that year of unforgettable stories and events. What do you remember about 63?
Well, I wasn't alive.
Oh, that's right.
But I've heard it was a big and tragic and momentous year in the nation. And R here, R does not want her full name to be used for reasons that may become obvious once you hear the story.
Yep.
Definitely has a memorable experience from 1963. So let's get after it.
You should know that I have had this story pent up inside of me for 61 years. And I'm going to share it all with you tonight. So this story, to set the scene, takes place in a borough of New York known as Queens, New York, which is discrepantly also referred to as the Forgotten Borough, in a neighborhood known as Jamaica. Jamaica Estates, to be exact. Okay. And it was the first planned community in all of New York City. But it was actually the brainchild of the same engineer and developer that developed the subway. It was intended to be exclusionary and not inclusionary. Jim Rouse be damned. And the style of architecture was intended to fake you out into thinking that you were in an English town, okay? So kind of like Cotswolds, you know? So there was a lot of stucco. There was a lot of flagstone. There was a lot of stained glass windows, except for this one house that had kind of a cross between a Greek, sort of a Greco formal design with columns and a brick facade, kind of reflective a little bit of like Tara in Gone with the Wind. You know what I'm thinking? You know, like da-da-da-da. Okay, that kind of a look. And the cast of characters in Jamaica Estates in the early 1990s was kind of like the first act of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, okay? So we had the funeral director that lived on one side of us. We had a Lionel train collector on the other side. There was one other token Italo-American family, the Bellettis, who owned the bicycle shop on Jamaica Avenue. There was the benevolent crossing guard, okay? There was the IBM executive with the Irish triplets across the street, you know, Joan Francis, Barbara Lynn, and Lil Marie. And Lil Marie is, to this day, my best friend. And then there was this wealthy family down the street that lived in Tara, okay, we'll call it. Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. And growing up in the early 1960s, the parenting style was a little different. Okay, so there were the discipline was strong but more lax on things. We were left to our own devices. Okay, we learned through experience. To give you an idea, the monkey bars in my school were on a pavement. Okay, all right, and in those days for me, I was a young kid. This was pre-street smart, because whenever I say to people, yeah, I'm from New York, they think I'm kind of like tough. But at that stage, I was naive, I was curious, and I was gullible. Now, when my parents bought this house, it was sheer coincidence that they found this house. They were living downtown on the Lower East Side. somewhere between Delancey and Essex Street. And they decided one day to take a ride on the Independence subway just to explore what was at the very terminus of the E and the F train. So they wander out, and there amongst the English Cotswold houses, appropriately street names of Avon and Chelsea and Croydon and Wareham, right there on Midland Parkway was a neglected house, overgrown lawn, with a for sale sign that had fallen over. And that was the house that my parents bought. Now, unbeknownst to them, the address of that house was one digit off from a very wealthy tycoon living in Tara. Da, 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 da. Okay. So it was not uncommon for the mailman, innocently, to deliver our mail to Tara, and we would get their mail. So on one of these instances, we got Blanche's Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog, and I was sent down the street to Tara to return this Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog. So up I go, past the lantern-bearing jockeys over to the front. I ring the doorbell. Now, you should know, just a sideline descriptive, that my mother was still teaching downtown in this inner city as a first grade and second grade teacher. And in those days, the early 1960s, there was no such thing as multiracial basal readers. No such thing. And because Mom wanted material that was appropriate to the socioeconomics of her class for bulletin boards and so on, we always had a subscription to Ebony Magazine. So off I go to deliver Blanche's Neiman Marcus catalog, and of course the housekeeper hands me Mother's Ebony Magazine, and off I go. Now, I pass this house, Tara, on almost a daily basis. I passed it on my way to school. I passed it on the way to the post, to the mailbox. And on one particular time, as the youngest of the family, it was one of my chores, was to walk to Hillside Avenue to the bakery. Now, anybody of Italo-American descent knows that a place setting in an Italian household has a third utensil, and that's known as a piece of Italian bread. So there I was with my 35 cents going down to Hillside Avenue, and I'm walking by Tara, and in the driveway is this ruddy-skinned, blonde, sort of yellow-blonde guy, a little older than me, with a hose in his hand. And in the driveway is a red Corvair. Not a Corvette, a Corvair. You know that mid-engine thing? Yeah, yeah. And he's getting ready to wash his car, and he looks up at me and he says, "Hey, kid, you want to help wash my car?" And because I was innocent, curious, and gullible, I said, "Oh, okay." So he hands me a rag, and he proceeds to in-service me on the intricacies of buffing the spokes on the hubcaps of this Corvair. So I finish my chore, I hand him the rag back. Back I go down to Hillside Avenue to get my loaf of seeded semolina, and back I go. I didn't think much of this. Fast forward a couple of months, it's Halloween, 1963. Lil Marie Callanan and I are going out through the neighborhood, you know, Wareham, Avon, Chelsea, Dalney, you know, ringing doorbells, trick-or-treating. And there, at the corner of Midland and Croydon, is the same guy leaning up against a telephone pole. And he says, "Hey, kid, open your bag. Let me see what you got." And because I was innocent, curious, and gullible, I said, "Oh, okay." And I open my bag, and he proceeds to cull the best candy off the top. Out goes the Mary Janes and the Milk Duds and the Good and Plenties. Now, you may be wondering why I am fixated on this story about this neighborhood thug who made me polish his hubcaps and took my best Halloween candy. Because he went on to be the 45th president of the United States.
That's all I had. Thank you for listening.
That was such a fun reveal.
Did you see that coming?
I mean, I did because I booked her for the
story. I did not see it coming at all.
Oh, my God, you didn't?
Not
at all.
Not at all, because I think I wasn't thinking the timing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just,
man,
that is deliciously surprising.
And I think it's, you know, I was like, are you? Given the litigious nature of the individual that she's is talking about in the story, I was like, is it okay if we use it on the podcast? She's like, yeah, I'm not saying anything, you know, I'm not accusing him of what many people have accused him of and things like that. I'm just talking about how he was as a young man, which is very on brand given how he is now. So, but she's a delight. I love her.
And I love that she said, I've been waiting to tell this story for 61 years.
Yeah.
It's like, saddle up. So before we get to our next story, we're going to take a quick break. This next story, man, this is an epic yarn. I feel like I could almost see this playing out visually. I don't want to say too much. Just take a listen.
So I was 4 years old in 1963, and my family moved to Athania Street in Aspen Hill, Maryland, on a little cul-de-sac dotted by eight homes. Each one was 1,200 square feet and made affordable by the GI Bill for people returning from World War II and also the Korean War. My father was a Korean War veteran, and he was able, for the whopping price of $10,000, to buy one of these little houses on this little cold, quiet cul-de-sac for $10,000. Anyway, my family had moved there, and if we go forward in time, CBS News did a story on 1963, looking back in history, and they dubbed 1963 to be the year that everything happened. In 1963, Beatlemania took over America on all the airways. A guy named, a musician named Bob Dylan had just released his album with a song called Blowin' in the Wind. And that would become the anthem for a whole generation of baby boomers that were just coming of age. In 1963, Martin Luther King stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and to a crowd of 250,000 people, he delivered his iconic speech, I Have a Dream. And in that same year, the youngest president ever in our history, the 35th president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated. He was a champion for civil rights, but he also, maybe less known, before he passed, he made a speech, his own iconic speech, to Congress and the world, pronouncing that America would land a man safely on the moon and bring him back to Earth. It was a year in 1963 of civil unrest and social injustice. And in that time period, it was sort of this calmness it was sort of a time when people had this live for today attitude. And in that period, parents often let their children, you know, go outside and travel even long distances unaccompanied by adults. It was a great time to grow up as a kid. And it was never more true than on a little cul-de-sac in Aspen Hill, Maryland called Athania Street. So with that backdrop, it was a brisk morning in the fall of 1963. The parents on Athania Street had a certain psychological comfort in knowing that their children could venture out and play under the watchful eyes of neighbors. So my brother Stephen and I, Stephen was five and I was almost four, we ventured out. And as we ran to the end of our little cul-de-sac and we came to the white picket posts that were the boundaries between our little street and the grounds of the Mary Magdalene Church, we stepped onto the green grassy field, and it was our adopted playground. And as I looked to my right, as far as my eyes could see, was the second oldest and the fifth largest pet cemetery in America. Over 50,000 pets were buried there, including 70 horses and hundreds of frogs and turtles and rabbits. and thousands of cats and dogs with names like Fluffy and Jigs and Rags. And yes, my brother Stephen and I, we would sometimes play among the tombstones, but not on this morning. And as we kept running on the left side of the field, the length of the field was a tall fence that stretched the length of the field. And at the very far end was the towering Mary Magdalene Church. And Stephen and I came to a stop in the middle of the field to probably the most our favorite place in the world. It was an old apple tree. And I stood there looking up as my brother Steve, for the first time, climbed onto that first branch. It had only been a year earlier that my oldest brother, Marty, climbed into this tree. And as I sat there looking at my brother on this branch, straddling the branch, pretending he was a flying ace, and my eyes went beyond Stephen and well into the canopy of the tree, as I imagined the path that I would take when I was just a few inches taller. And Stephen looked down from the branch and he yelled, "I'm hit, I'm hit." And I have to parachute out. And I stepped back as Stephen tumbled into a pile of leaves. And Stephen and I both laughed as he brushed himself off. And then he said, "I'll race you." And we started heading across the field, kicking up acorns and leaves. And as we approached the far side of the field, it was Stephen who noticed it first. There was a small hole in the fence, but it was big enough for two children, 5 and 4, two little boys, to crawl through. And I could still hear the echo of my mom in my head, "Stay in the field. Don't go out of the field." But the allure was too great for any little children with any sense of adventure. And a minute later, we were on the other side of the fence. And as you looked along the stretch of the fence, at the base of the fence was a little pathway, maybe 2 feet wide. And the pathway sloped down, not so gently, to a hill that ran another 6 to 8 feet. And that reached the top of a cement wall that dropped another 15 to 20 feet to the asphalt alley below. The alley separated the wall from the Aspen Hill, back of the Aspen Hill Shopping Center, which was a little strip center back then, on the other side of the alley. So Stephen and I sat there looking at this sight. It was eerily quiet. And then my brother Steve broke the silence. "I'll race ya." And we're off and running along the base of the fence. And I don't know whether it was an untied shoelace or whether it was a stump or whether I was just 4 years old, but I found myself sliding down the hill. And I was grabbing on the grass, and then I was sailing over the wall. And the first thing to hit was my top of my skull, right across here, and it cracked. And my brother Steve stood at the top of the wall, looking down at his little brother, laying motionless but conscious. And then the silence was broken. Way above Stephen on a telephone pole, the top of the pole, a man working for CMP Telephone Company, a linesman, sees me fall. And he yells to my brother, "Get your mother! Get your mother!" My brother was through the hole and running as fast as he could. And at the same time, the man reached into his toolbox and he pulled out a wire. And on one end was a little earpiece that he stuck in his ear, and the other were two clamps. And he literally clamped into the wire that stretched from the pole, and in no time at all, he was talking through a switchboard operator to Holy Cross Hospital. Now, Holy Cross Hospital had just opened that year, and they had several years of red tape. And if not for Holy Cross, I wouldn't be standing here tonight. The next closest hospital was too far. Now, why the man is talking to Holy Cross Hospital, as I slid over the wall, the back door of the shopping center, the strip center, opened, and an employee, a teenager, maybe 17 or 18, taking a break from work, happens to step into the alley. He sees me fall. He grabs a piece of cardboard that's leaning against the wall, and he runs towards me. He kneels down. He slides the cardboard under me. He takes his jacket off. He puts it over me. And then he sits there, and he calmly talks to me. He says, "Stay still. Don't move. Help is coming. You're going to be okay." And it was only a couple minutes when the ambulance came screaming around into the alley. Now, back in 1963, only 50% of the emergency transport vehicles were ambulances. The other 50% were funeral home hearse, flatbed trucks, and in some cases, maybe even just a station wagon large enough to hold a stretcher. The ambulance came to a screeching stop. The two attendants came running towards me carrying the stretcher. Now, back in 1963, we didn't have EMTs. They called them attendants because they literally just had a driver's license, a strong enough back to carry a stretcher, and maybe a basic first aid course by the American Red Cross. But the important thing was they had me in the ambulance. And my mother, she made it just in time to jump in, and we were off. Meanwhile, back at Holy Cross Hospital, there was some chaos. The emergency team knew I was coming, and they were preparing to meet me at the front. And then they realized that the surgeon was not in the hospital. He had left for the day, and somebody said he's in the back parking lot, and maybe we can catch him. So one of the team members ran through the corridors of Holy Cross out the back door and literally pulled the surgeon, Dr. John Lord, L-O-R-D, aptly named. They pulled Dr. Lord from the car. Now, remember, back in 1963, they didn't have mobile phones. They didn't have pagers. We had those dial phones that you just one at a time that were tethered to a wall. If it had been a minute later, Dr. Lord would have been in his car and heading home, and I wouldn't be standing here today. Now, meanwhile, Dr. Lord's in surgery now, and the rest of the crew's in the front of the hospital, along with my father, because my father, who was called by a neighbor, ran every red light and was standing in front of the hospital when the ambulance pulled up to a stop and my mom stepped out. And my mom and dad stood there and watched their young son taken straight into surgery. It would be many hours before Dr. Lord would appear. And when Dr. Lord came through the door, he looked at my parents, and in a solemn, quiet way, he wanted to prepare them for the worst. He said it was really serious. He said if your son was any older, his skull would have shattered. And if he was any younger, it would have caved in. He said, now, he was just the right age that it cracked. But unfortunately, a piece of skull was inside of his head, and it's pressing against his brain. And we had difficulty getting to the piece of skull. And I literally, he said, molded a piece of an instrument and was able to get the piece of skull and pull it in place. But I need you to understand, it's very unlikely that Brian will live. And if he does live, it's highly probable that he will be unresponsive in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Now, my mom and dad took a minute to take in the silence. And then a nurse came screaming down the hall. Dr. Lord, Dr. Lord, it's Brian, it's Brian. My mom didn't want to hear the rest of the sentence because she kind of knew what it meant. And so she ran down the hall past Dr. Lord and the nurse and ran into the room with the nurse and doctor behind her. And as she approached my crib, expecting the worst, she looked over the side of the crib, and I was laying in the crib, eyes wide open, two black eyes, and the words came out of my mouth, Mommy, can we go home now? Now, I'm grateful. That was 61 years ago, almost to the day, and I'm grateful for every day that I've had on this earth, and I'm particularly grateful for the man on the pole who had the presence of mind to plug in and call Holy Cross. He could have climbed down that pole. I would have not been here. The young boy in the alley, the teenager, 17, 18 years old, who stood by my side, if I had moved even a little bit, I wouldn't be here tonight. And certainly for the surgeon, Dr. John Lord, who literally had an inspiration during the surgery to mold that piece of tool to pull that skull from my brain. And so I've learned that even the smallest heroes, you know, large and small, the people, my neighbors, who prepared meals for my family and babysat my siblings, why my mom tended to me. But even for all of us, all the heroes in our life that we know, and they may know or not know the things they've done, because even the smile from a stranger can change the trajectory of somebody's life. And my hope is that we're all inspired to know that we have the power to be the hero in somebody else's story. Thank you.
Does such a good job of taking us step by step through. I agree. Like, yeah. I could
yeah.
see
and
the
at every moment. It's like, if this person hadn't been there, if this guy had know how to mold this tool, like, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And then I thought afterward, like, God, what a lot of pressure to, in some way, to be like, all these lucky things happened that allowed me to still be taking breaths here on this earth. Like, just because of who I am, I'm like, oh, God, what a burden to live up to, you know?
He seems up to the task, though. He's a really good guy. And I don't know. I can't remember if he says this in the story. He donates so much blood. He does that kind of thing. Like, he's like one of the top blood donors in, like, the country.
He
like,
doesn't say that. Oh, my
gosh.
Oh,
yeah. He just figures out ways to give back while still, you know, being, like, you know, his own – capitalist, yeah. you know, yeah. like he's got a good job. He created a good life for his family. And then once he got that out of the way, he's like figuring out ways to give back to the community. It's really, he's a good guy. We like the Brian Jollis.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We're so glad you were here to share the stories with us. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast. And we want to let you know that if you visit stoopstorytelling.com, you can get tickets for the Stoop Holiday Hootenanny, an evening of holiday stories and music. And this is going to be at Baltimore's famous Senator Theater yep. on December 3rd. And it's always a really great show. So if you love the holidays or you hate the holidays, you will connect
you.
And relate to everything. So visit us at stoopstorytelling.com and remember the Stoop Holiday Show on Tuesday, December 3rd.